Back with you on Thursday, March 24th, 2022 on Connecticut Today. I wondered why the front of the program, exceptions are constantly made in society for athletes and entertainers, especially in the area of COVID-19. All one has to do is look at the recent actions of New York Mayor Eric Adams. Law enforcement veteran, local author, New Haven native, former Brantford cop Greg Dillon talked about his new book, The Thin Blue Lie, An Honest Cop Versus the FBI. Quinnipiac University's Executive Director of Religious Life, Father James Lenihan, detailed his recent trip to Ukraine. And you know what? This whole scenario in New York is a bigger illustration of, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about the fact that all of a sudden, because we're getting close to baseball season and we're getting close to NBA playoff time, the mayor of New York decides to undo something that was stupid to begin with, in my opinion, a private employer vaccine mandate that was put in the final stretches of the de Blasio term. And you know what this means? Now, I know what the mayor's out there saying today. Well, we need the money. New York has to be money, has to be money-centric tourism. I get it. But understand something. And this is where the vapid thinking of politicians really comes to the forefront here. If this exception was not made, let's say the mayor said, nope, sorry, don't care how many of the Mets and or the Yankees are unvaccinated. Don't care if Kyrie Irving doesn't play any home games during the playoffs. No, don't care if the Broadway shows ever go on or not, or an unvaccinated star can't act in this gazillion-dollar Broadway revival that everybody wants to see. If he had said that, guess what? The shows, the games, they go on. They go on. This is an illustration of sometimes, right? And as much as you and I love sports, we talk about it occasionally here on the show, especially when certain things in sports become part of the narrative of what's going on, like it is today. But as much as we love sports and entertainment and all that sort of stuff, life goes on. I mean, the games would have still been played in New York, even if the Yankees and the Mets were at a competitive disadvantage. In the grand scheme of things, people still would have went. I know they would have bitched and moaned about it, but they still would have went. They still would have charged you $40 to park your car. You still would have been buying $10 hot dogs. You still would have been buying $15 beers. If you're on Broadway, you still would have been paying $75, $100, $150, $200 a seat to see a Broadway play. If you're an NBA fan, you still would have went to a home playoff game for the Nets, whether or not Kyrie Irving played or not. It just shows the outsized aspect that we've had in this country, and many countries have had around the world for years and years and years. Whether we want to do it or not, or whether we actively admit it or not, we place actors, actresses, athletes, musicians, for some reason we are so dependent on our entertainment to keep us sane. We're so dependent to see that concert or to go to that movie or to go to that game or to go to that Broadway play that we will treat other far more valuable people in society differently. We will put, as the teachers union is saying in New York now, as some of the police unions are saying, we will put the people who protect us from death, we will put the people who save our lives in certain situations, EMTs, fire crews like that, we will come down on them with a much more heavy hand than we do on people who, listen, love them or not, we all like our Major League Baseball, we all like our basketball playoffs, we all like going to theater and Broadway, some of us anyway. I'll be there Monday to see a preview of a show my son's working on. But man, are we duplicitous or what? I mean, in the grand scheme of things, ask yourself this, in the grand scheme of things, if, now it's not going to happen because the mayor rescinded this, I get this, I understand this, but in the grand scheme of things, let's say that Aaron Judge for the Yankees had pulled a Kyrie Irving that Kyrie was doing with the Nets, or let's say that by some stretch of whatever we found out, Jacob DeGrom was not vaccinated. And let's say that neither DeGrom nor Aaron Judge were able to play any home games this year. Okay. In the grand scheme of things, in the grand scheme of life moving on in society and loving people and getting along and loving your family and doing your job, in the grand scheme of things, who cares? Honestly, who cares? Sometimes our thinking is so warped on this stuff. It really is. It's warped. It goes beyond fandom. It goes beyond fandom. And I know sports is and entertainment and music and theater and movies, that's a bromide for people and they get it. But it is so warped now that, you know, we have an example here where New York goes, for the past couple of months, nope, private employers don't care whether they're sports teams or anything. You got to be vaccinated. Oh, never mind. Because when the teams and the leagues start turning the screws on politicians, which happened here, make no doubt about that, we suddenly go back into this spotlight, this Kliegelite society where, we know that 1,400 people lost their job in New York, and we know that the teachers and the police and the fire and the EMT are all mad, but hey, got to get everybody in the lineup, though, for opening day. Oh, my God. We are such phonies. We are such, and by we, I mean how we govern ourselves, how we look at things. We are such grade A phonies. It's laughable. You have to laugh at sometimes, not everyone, not everything every day, but it's sometimes you have to love at just how gosh darn phony we are, especially when it comes to money. And we'd like to have local authors of note in and about the Connecticut area, and our next guest is one of those. He joined the Brantford Police Department back in 1978 before becoming an FBI special agent in 1985. He worked on the Criminal Reactive Squad in Alexandria, Virginia, then on the Violent Crime Squad in the nation's capital in 1990, he took a position as an inspector in the office of the Chief State's Attorney here in Connecticut. And during 30-plus years of law enforcement, the gentleman here received numerous commendations and awards before retiring back in 2009 as a supervisor inspector. Name of the book is The Thin Blue Lie, An Honest Cop Versus the FBI. We welcome the author, Greg Dillon, to the program. Greg, hi, it's Paul on WICC. How are you?
Very good, Paul. Thank you for having me on today.
Brantford native, huh? So your formative years were on the shoreline, huh?
Well, I was born and raised in New Haven, once I graduated from the University of New Haven, I applied to the Brantford Police Department and was hired.
Nice. So you had the foundation, Greg, of being a local cop. How did that help you in your career?
Well, it gave me a big advantage going into the FBI because, oddly enough, there's many agents that had no prior law enforcement background. They might have been attorneys or accountants, but had no criminal investigative experience. So I did feel I had a built-in advantage when I was hired.
So you were assigned, I see here, to a federal fugitive task force here in Connecticut, but under the auspices of the Fed. But it says you uncovered a pattern of misconduct and falsified affidavits. So, Greg, take us through that, because that's the kind of stuff people want to hear about and what you were able to uncover. When did this start becoming like an aha moment for you?
About 1996, I accidentally came across a federal warrant that had been submitted to federal court, and I realized that there was information on there that was attributed to me that was false. I don't want to say misleading. It was more than misleading. It was false. And I was not quite sure what the appropriate response should be, hoping that it was an unintentional oversight, some type of a miscommunication, mm-hmm. But then I went back and I started to pull some older warrants, and I realized that this was actually a pattern. This was not a one-off or an aberration. This was this happened more than once. I asked a few of my colleagues to go back and review some older warrants to see if the same thing had happened with them, and in fact, it did. At that point, I had seven documented examples of falsified affidavits, and I was obligated to report it to my supervisor, who was the chief state's attorney.
So what was the reaction of your colleagues, Greg Dillon, when you said, hey, you should go back and check this stuff, and you said they had similar discoveries? What was their reaction?
Yeah, they were aghast also. I mean, they cannot believe not only was it happening, but that they were the sources of the false information. So we had no choice at that point. We had to call attention to it, and the response was completely unexpected. We suffered retaliation individually and collectively, and ultimately I was forced to file a federal lawsuit because of it.
All right, hang on. We're going to get more into that fascinating story here. The name of the book is The Thin Blue Lie, An Honest Cop versus the FBI. New Haven native Greg Dillon is the guest. Greg, hang on. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. Greg Dillon is the guest, New Haven native, former Branford cop who went on to work for the FBI. Greg Dillon's book, The Thin Blue Lie, L-I-E, The Thin Blue Lie, and he explains what happened to him over a stretch where he was shocked to find in affidavits things that were said to be attributed to him and his colleagues. Greg says that that were not. Now, Greg, you said you went ahead and raised the red flag and said, whoa, right? Why is my name in here? I guess your friends did, too. Your colleagues did, too. What kind of blowback did you get on this?
Well, at the time, we did not realize that the chief state's attorney, who was then Jack Bailey, had aspirations of a federal appointment to the Department of Justice. So he took the approach that we were to talk to no one about this. He issued a gag order in writing and reminded us in person that if we wanted to speak about it publicly, we'd have to resign. Then he proceeded to remove us from the task force and transfer us to different courthouses across the state.
You must have been incensed by this. How were you feeling? How angry were you at this time?
I was infuriated because we were telling the truth and he was providing cover for the FBI. When I came back to the office, I was now no longer a supervisor, and I decided to finally have to go seek legal counsel. And we eventually filed a federal lawsuit for a violation of my First Amendment right to free speech.
So the point here, Greg Dillon, is that they needed to bolster these cases. In other words, did they think, they being the ubiquitous they, Greg, did the people above you in the prosecutorial ranks, did someone or some people think, hey, we need to make these cases, at least on the evidentiary level and the affidavit level, look more solid? Is that why they took these liberties or not?
Yes, they wanted to guarantee that the warrant would be approved by a federal judge or a federal magistrate. And as the book explains, there was a method to the madness. They were financially motivated to try to get the biggest numbers of warrants through that they could, because there was financial incentive. There was either cash awards, one agent was promoted to a supervisor, and there were in-grade salary bumps, and this was probably the driving factor behind them trying to get as many of these federal warrants signed as they could.
One of the best movies I think, Greg, I ever saw growing up years and years ago was the movie Serpico, and what Frank Serpico went through with his whistleblowing in the really rotten days of the NYPD. And you got help from Frank Serpico in this? How did that happen, and what was that like?
I did. After we had had our trial, the judge wanted to hold an injunction hearing as to whether a gag order was ever appropriate under these circumstances. So Chief State's Attorney Bailey brought in several expert witnesses to testify to his position, and we needed someone to rebut that. And we called on Frank Serpico, who came out of his, I don't want to say hiding. He wasn't actually hiding by that point in his life, but he sort of lived as a recluse.
Mm-hmm.
And he came out and provided support. And that was the turning point where they decided that they were going to settle the case once and for all.
How much did you know about Frank Serpico growing up or in this? Had you ever seen the movie? Had you written the book? How much did you know about him?
I actually had the first printing of his book.
Wow.
When I was attending the University of New Haven for law enforcement, I was captivated by the story. So I had bought the book before it even became a movie, and then, of course, I'd watched the movie. So I was really thrilled to actually get to meet him in person and spend some time with him while he was in Connecticut.
How much of a help did Frank Serpico give you and your attorneys and everything to get to the resolution you wanted? How valuable was that?
Well, Paul, we had won the jury award, but the state was going to appeal it to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals mm-hmm. in New York.
Yeah,
and that's we were at that point when they learned that we had Frank Serpico here to come in and testify, and at that point they folded their tent and said enough's enough. We're going to withdraw the appeal.
Somebody may hear your story, Greg, and hopefully they pick up the book, The Thin Blue Lie, An Honest Cop Versus the FBI. It's available everywhere. I'm looking at it right now on Amazon. People get discouraged, Greg, when they hear and read about this stuff, because we have this image, Greg Dillon, do we not, of law enforcement, from the municipal cop, like you were at one time, all the way up to the feds, that we want to trust them. We don't want to hear. We hate hearing about corruption and this stuff. What would you tell a person who may hear your story and say, well, see, what did I tell you? Here's a guy who got caught in the middle of it. How do you think people should react to this, Greg?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Paul, you should say that, because today alone, I received an email from an FBI agent, and I also received a telephone call from someone in the state police. And it's always sort of a similar version of what I went through. Maybe not to the degree I went through, but apparently, this type of behavior still exists, whether it's at the local level, the state level, or the federal level. So I'm routinely hearing back from people who have read the book about how they relate to it, how they can sympathize, and how they've experienced something or are currently experiencing something that they find very, very similar.
So I get...
The book explains...
No, go ahead. I'm sorry, Greg. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the book explains sort of what to expect in what you are in store for. So it's a bit of a tutorial, maybe, but it explains, you know, the perils of a whistleblower, what you're going to face and what can happen to you. So it's a lesson.
How many people in your line of work, men and women, Greg, do you think experience this but say, nah, I can't. I got to bite my lip here. I got kids, a wife or a husband, a partner and a mortgage. I can't afford an attorney. Does it bother you that some people just don't think they should speak up?
Most of them won't. There's been studies done, and it's not that there's not much misconduct to report. It's the fact that no one wants to be the one to throw the penalty flag. It's not a career builder, and as anyone who reads the book will realize, that my career was frozen in place. I could never advance myself after the lawsuit, despite working for another 14 years in the state. And a lot of people that witness this stuff will just turn a blind eye to it, ignore it, and pretend it doesn't exist, because they do not want to get stuck in the middle of it. And honestly, I can understand their position.
All right, final question, Greg Dillon, before we let you go. Who would you prefer plays you in the movie? Have you picked out anybody yet?
I've eliminated a few people, but I haven't settled on anyone. But if Mark Wahlberg is listening, I would say please pick up a copy of the book and let's talk.
Hey, listen, send it. Send it to his people. There's always people, right? That's how these guys take roles sometimes, right? No, somebody doesn't say no, and they finally get to read it. Why not, Greg?
Thank you, Paul. I'll try it.
All right. The name of the blue, check it out. The name of the book, rather, is The Thin Blue Lie, L-I-E, The Thin Blue Lie, An Honest Cop versus the FBI. Like me, a New Haven native, that's where the comparison ends, though. Greg Dillon went on to be a local cop in Branford and then rose to the ranks with the FBI, but got mixed up in stuff that he knew was wrong, and he spoke out about it. Greg Dillon, thank you. We appreciate it. Be good, my friend, and we'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Greg Dillon, D-I-L-L-O-N, Greg Dillon, New Haven native, former Branford cop, and now has a book out there that, folks, it's got 5-star reviews and more than just a few reviews on Amazon.com, The Thin Blue Lie, An Honest Cop versus the FBI. We talk about it here in the program. We look at the video on the news channels. We see the video shared on social media about what it's like in Ukraine and also what it's like for refugees on the border, largely escaping Ukraine into Poland. And a gentleman right now joins us. He made a recent 10-day humanitarian trip to the border of Ukraine and Poland, and we welcome here to WICC Father Jordan Lenihan. He's Executive Director of Religious Life at Quinnipiac University. Father Lenihan, it's Paul Pacelli here. How are you, sir?
Fine, thank you, Paul. Nice to speak to you and your audience today.
Well, thank you. First of all, Father, how did the trip, the 10-day trip to the Ukraine-Poland border come about? How did you end up going and why?
Well, there are three of us in the Dominican community here in New Haven, and one of us works for the Knights of Columbus, and so he was going over in that capacity and taking another Dominican priest with him who edits National Catholic News Service. In conjunction with their visit, he said to me, why don't you come over as well and take the third member of the community? I had worked in Poland and in Ukraine, and I have sort of area familiarity and language experience. And he said it would be good and helpful just to get a sense of what the situation was like on the ground, what they need, what the story actually looks like, and whether or not we could make some connections ourselves that would allow us to funnel aid and material and support to people in need. And that's how it began. We had about 72 hours notice to prepare to go.
Wow. And calling on the experience, Father Lenihan, that you had, you say, in Ukraine and Poland, did that prepare you for what you were able to see there and the people you were able to talk to?
Actually, in some sense, yes, because I had language ability. And that really makes a lot of the difference. Now, to be quite honest, we wound up going in an unmarked humanitarian truck, having been handed over to a Russian-speaking, Ukrainian passport-holding trucking company that sort of got us across the border and dropped us off. But otherwise, we were kind of on our wits. That said, having lived in Russia, having lived in Poland, I had a sense of like the rhythm of what life is like there. So that made it a lot less challenging. And I had been to Lviv before, so I had some sense of the city.
It must, I would imagine then, Father, with your background there, it's got to, I mean, look, it pains everyone, but I can imagine the range of emotions that you felt there just looking over what was going on.
Absolutely. It's hard to describe. As soon as we crossed the border, you began to see sort of individuals or small groups of people, sometimes young, sometimes old, just walking down the two-lane highway with pushing a carriage or carrying suitcases. And it the images so often during this trip reminded me of things you would see on a historical documentary on the History Channel about the Second World War. Mm. But it was right there, and there we were 20 feet away. Frequently we would see, as you know, frequently the men stay behind to fight, and it's the women or children that are walking off and trying to get to safety, either in Western Ukraine or in Poland or one of the other nearby countries. But they're traumatized. And frequently we would see what Father Joachim and I began to refer to as trauma eyes, where the mother would be able to, she'd be caring for the kids and doing what needed to be done, but her eyes were wide and the stare was blank. And so we frequently saw that in on the Ukrainian side among those who were displaced.
Father Jordan Linehan is the Executive Director of Religious Life at Quinnipiac University. More on his recent trip, his 10-day humanitarian trip to the Ukraine-Poland border. Straight ahead, Father, hang on. We'll be back with you. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. All right, back to open phones momentarily. First, though, a few more minutes. Fascinating discussion with Father Jordan Linehan. He is the Executive Director of Religious Life at Quinnipiac University in Hamden. He, along with a few other folks, had a recent 10-day humanitarian trip to the border of Ukraine and Poland. Father Linehan, what did you hear from not only people on the Polish side, but from Ukrainians coming over the border? Did they expect this? Were they caught off guard? Do they think that they will never go home again? What did you hear?
Well, that's a great question, because we actually spent the majority of our time not on the border, but actually in the city of Lviv in Ukraine, talking to people about this situation and the experience. What struck me, speaking to the woman who directs the largest shelter in the city at the arena, said to me when I asked her about how many percent of the people that you're currently housing will move on and go across the border into Poland or one of the other countries. And she said less than 5%. So it's a very different story when you get over there. But what do we hear? We talk to a number of people, Paul. We talk to police officers, the shelter director. We talk to priests. We talk to university students. Sadly, every person said to us they did not expect to survive this ordeal. At the same time, every person said to us they will fight. And the tenaciousness, the way that they just sort of embraced what has to be and they were just stepping up, it was really an occasion of the ordinary folks being called to do the extraordinary in ordinary circumstances.
All the military experts that you hear now, Father Linehan, are all saying that because of the fortitude of the Ukrainian people, a conventional war will never likely succeed for Russia unless they just completely end-to-end destroy the country and everyone in it. And now we're getting the notion that Mr. Putin may tragically resort to chemical warfare or worse. Is that a testament, do you think, to the guts of the Ukrainian people that they will not simply, maybe as Vladimir Putin thought, they simply won't roll over and they won't run?
Absolutely. You know, a few years ago, I gave a paper in Copenhagen on irregular warfare, and one of the military officers from a Western nation said that the Cold War doctrine was that each one of the Western European nations had to hold the Soviet army back for only 24 hours, which in tandem would allow the Americans to get over. Everyone thought the Ukrainians would collapse in 72, 48 hours, but they didn't. These people are tough, and their resiliency, their tenaciousness, their commitment, the way that they've sort of pulled together, it was admirable. I'm going to tell you, Paul, I've read widely, I've studied in this area, I've lived in this area, but I went into Ukraine with the situation being academic. In other words, in my head, I left 3 days later and this situation had moved from being academic to becoming personal.
The leader of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, I would gather, Father, that, 6 months ago, people would have thought, oh, yeah, didn't the Rangers just sign him, to play in the NHL in the playoffs?
Yeah.
I mean,
exactly.
Right? Hey, he's got a hell of a slap shot from what I heard. But, this guy is now, for lack of a better term, a star. This guy was a television comic. I think Netflix is rerunning his series. What do people think of him? I mean, you talk about an unlikely rise with Mr. Zelensky here.
Absolutely. Look, one of my favorite stories told about him was when he took office, they all said, well, we've got to put your picture up in all of the offices. Pretty common across the world. He said, no, don't put my picture up. He said, I'm not an icon. He said, put a picture up instead of your family's. And so that when you make decisions or determinations, that's who you're thinking about.
Finally, Father, what if anything, can the religious forces do here? You know, we have the Catholic Church, we have the Eastern Orthodox Church, you have the Russian monarch, but in a warped way, you have Mr. Putin talking about, you know, Christianity and Jesus. The Pope seems very angry about this. Is there, Father Lenihan, anything that the religious world can do to maybe end this sooner or not?
Well, I think that what's happened is the premise of your question, I think, is problematic because it suggests that he actually is sincerely using religion. I think Putin has weaponized religion for his own ends because it fits into a larger narrative to motivate certain segments of his population. It strikes me that having been in Poland, having been on the border, having been in Ukraine, the vast majority of humanitarian resources that are flooding into the country to help these folks are all coming from religious sources. And I think watching the Pope, watching the Ecumenical Patriarch in Constantinople, watching hierarchs in this country of all stripes come out and condemn this sort of perversion of religion and its weaponization to justify naked political aggression, I think that becomes important. You've got to just call things out for what they are. But more to the point, it's religious folks also often who are mobilizing to bring aid and help and assistance, and at least in our case, hope for the people that we met.
Father Jordan Lenihan is Executive Director of Religious Life at Quinnipiac University. Father, good to speak with you again. Take care, and let's reconnect down the line. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Father Jordan Lenihan, he is Executive Director of Religious Life at Quinnipiac University. How about that? He lived over there and in Ukraine and in Russia. What must he have thought or experienced seeing that in an area where you lived and worked and studied, and then you go back and it's a war zone? Folks, I'm telling you, we are so fortunate in this country. Everybody picks on America, the great Satan, this and the other. And we don't come anywhere close, not even in the same zip code of what a lot of people have to deal with around the world.